Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the smoothest glass of Amarula for your mind, that being two prickers at a thorn tree. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, joined, of course, by the other half of your hosts, as always.
Gabriel Krauser.
So, we missed a week, but Gabriel, you have been very, very busy, I understand. And we won't be able to talk about what you've been busy with this week, because it is...
Yeah, we should be able to... It's sub judice.
It's sub judice.
I've been called as an expert witness in a matter against Julius Malem, against the EFF.
So, wait.
Of hate speech.
You know what this means, right?
What?
Every time you can appear in being reported in writing or referencing yourself or appearing on TV, you can attach the descriptor expert to your name.
Yeah. Once you're an expert witness, you're an expert. I mean, I'm sure they're going to – I'm sure that I will be criticized by in cross-examination. I really can't talk about what the last week was like, but it was very interesting.
But yeah, we'll wait for that to be over and done with, and then we'll dive into the guts of it. I think it'll be fascinating. But until then, you linked onto one of the WhatsApp groups that we use for work a most spectacular article. Courtesy of CNN, writer Blake, John Blake.
John Blake, yeah.
And John Blake, I don't know if he's a front-facing personality, he's not one of their hosts or anything, he's I think listed as a producer and writer. And he wrote an article which said, Joe Rogan's use of the N-word is another January 6th moment. And he goes on to say that while no one was killed, and no one...
No. Nick, let me read this out so that we don't want to undermine this guy's way with words. The podcaster Joe Rogan did not join a mob that forced lawmakers to flee for their lives. He never carried a Confederate flag inside the U.S. Capitol rotunda. No one died trying to stop him from using the N-word. But what Rogan and those who defend him have done... since video clips of him using the N-word surfaced on social media is arguably just as dangerous as what a mob did when they stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6th last year. I think it's amazing. The headline is Joe Rogan's use of the N-word is another January 6th moment. And it is...
Essentially, he's trying to argue that this was a moral insurrection, as dangerous as a physical insurrection.
It's amazing.
I must say, that's a hot take if ever there was one.
It is so steamy. And so... One of the things that I think is interesting about it is that... It's based on some factually false premises. So the very next paragraph reads, Rogan breached the civic norm that has held America together since World War II. It's an unspoken agreement that we would never return to the kind of country we used to be. The agreement enrolled around this simple rule. A white person would never be able to publicly use the N-word again and not pay a price. Now, one of the ways that that's not true is Louis C.K., who did end up paying a very serious price for sort of bad behavior. I think he masturbated
in front of
a person, but it was not for this. He had a famous skit, and I'm going to keep saying N-word, even though I think for the specific and explicit purpose of not getting this. This podcast in trouble, rather than
hosted on platforms, it can be a bit tricky.
Yes, and I'll make clear why I make that reason explicit in a moment. But so Louis C.K.'s skit, it's actually a stand-up show where he sort of sets out to the audience that one of the things he's going to try and do is use the C word, the N word, the F word, and faggots, which I guess you can say because it's also got like a non-derogatory meaning. Anyway, he's going to use those four words in separate jokes, and then he's going to bring them all together in one joke. And his joke with the N-word is about like going to a coffee shop and there's a barista there, like a white dude with long flowing hair who's like, hey man, can I like get you anything? And he's like, yeah, can I get like a cappuccino? And the dude's like, whoa, yeah, I can do that. It's like amazed that he's like, I've got all of the things here that I need to do that. And he sort of makes it and with the milk and with the grinding of the beans. And it's like, you know, decorates it with a shamrock on the top and like, you know, just puts two little sprinkles of cinnamon. And he goes, and in Lucy K's head, he thinks, damn, that N-word made the shit out of my coffee. And then he rewound the tape in his head. Like, yes, I'm not trying to make the joke as funny as it can be, because that would require potentially breaking the rules. But he's like, you know, that anyway. Part of what's funny about the joke is that it really does have nothing to do with race. It's just like a fun sounding word. Another part of it is like, I was just watching Die Hard Revenge. I think the one that came out in 95. And that's got Samuel L. Jackson and Bruce Willis. It's not one of the ones I'd seen before. I was feeling quite sick, and so I was just sort of slumping in front of the TV. There's some very interesting and I would say, you know, like excellent conversations about race that are way ahead of their time.
Of Samuel L. Jackson, have you seen the interview where he talks about, I think he's talking to some interviewer about how the N-word, you know, are you okay with Tarantino saying the N-word in podcasts or in movies, sorry. And he basically says, go on, say it. And they get onto the topic of him saying it. And then he dares the reporter to say it. And he says, no, no, it's cool, just say it. And the reporter, you can see the blood flowing out of his face. It's the most spectacular, example of the way a taboo can physically affect a human being. It's incredible.
Yes.
And at the end, he's like, basically, even if I say it, they'll cut it from the interview, so I can't say it. So weasel out of it. But Samuel Jackson is rather annoyed by this.
Yeah, dude, and he says the same thing. He says the same thing as Lucy K's main line, and I actually have seen exactly that skit, Nick, quite recently. It's very good. Samuel L. Jackson is not on side with CNN on this. But Lucy K's main thing is like, no, you say it. By saying N-word, you're making me say it in my head.
Yes.
That's how language works. It's not like it's not like no one is saying it. It's just because you won't say it, now I have to say it. Either the context should justify it being said, in which case you say it, or the context doesn't justify it. Like if you're saying, hey, you N-word, don't do that. Like that doesn't make it better. You're just offloading the work. So it's also not bad. Also not good.
Actually, it does drive me mad that for some things people, it almost feels like an ancient kind of taboo about. So let me deviate slightly. I think it's the Finno-Ugric cultures, the like Sami people and the ancient Finns and stuff. They had this belief that you couldn't say the word bear. And one of the reasons
you just said it though. You just said it.
Yes. No, I just said it. I'm just saying it in context.
I'm afraid.
Don't kick us off. Don't kick us off.
Is that okay? Okay.
But you couldn't say the word bear for a number of reasons. One, bears were sacred to them. They thought that these were like embodiments of the sort of the like God spirit and all that. But also that saying the word bear, regardless of context, might summon the creature. And that's exactly the way that discussions about the N-word.
He who shall not be named. Dude, this is J.K. Rowling was so good at making fun of this. Like the people who really take out Lord Voldemort are the people who are not afraid to say his name. The people who are really actually ultimately complicit in the dark force sort of nearly overtaking wizardom are the people who think, here's how we're going to deal with the issue, okay? We're going to make a rule not to say a word. That's magical thinking. That's magical thinking that's so retarded that even in an actual book about magic, it's too stupid to, you know, the heroes see through that.
It's like, guys, we did it. No one can ever say the N-word again. We've solved racism.
Okay, but and so I want to, so another anecdote and then maybe a serious point. The anecdote is this. Trevor Noah, one of the first, so I was a fan of Trevor Noah, in South Africa before he went to the US.
I also liked him too.
And I saw him in his, one of his, maybe his first showcase, like he did five little stand-up gigs in New York City. Basically for, as it would turn out, the Daily Friend Show dudes to see if he could land it, in front of an American audience. And because I had fancy friends, I was sort of invited to one of these showcases. And what was very interesting about that is that you could hear where the South Africans were seated and where the Americans were seated. Because sort of two-thirds of the show, you know, it's only one half of the audience that's laughing. But he was really good at getting one, either the one side or the other side to laugh. And that was not a great sign. And then a third of it was just so good, everyone was laughing. And just to explain, what was scary was he was getting the Americans to laugh at the South African jokes and the South Africans to laugh at the American jokes. It wasn't like you have to be an insider to get it. It was like, no, he's like playing with the stereotype so nicely that like we find this to be a hilarious way of describing America. And the Americans found that to be a hilarious way of describing South Africa. Which is not the way you'd want it to be if it's going to be like that.
No, I suspect that what you saw there was perhaps the reasons why he's not nearly as funny as he used to be, which is playing to the one audience is a lot more money out of it than playing to the other one. I don't know.
Yeah, something like that. But also something like this. So I saw him do his first – part of the reason he's not so funny on the Daily Friend Show, I stopped watching it years ago, but I do watch like an episode.
Not the Daily Friend Show, the Daily Show.
The Daily Friend Show
is the good one that we do.
That's the good one. So. very good correction, Nick. is he sort of explicitly leaned into not being funny? In a way that Jerry Seinfeld would never do, and Louis C.K. and Ricky Gervais would never do. Like Ricky Gervais, if you have an interview with him, you can't go 4 minutes before he tries to make a joke. Whereas Jon Stewart and Stephen, Jon Stewart went the most unfunny. Colbert was always in character when he was doing the Colbert Report, so it was always kind of being funny. But Trevor Noah tried to pick up the Jon Stewart mantle of not being funny, but for longer stretches, and I think also with the sense of you've got a different perspective, so you're going to have to do this. Anyway, so he was at a college campus and taking questions and answers and sort of not being funny in like my subjective opinion sense, not being funny in the sense that like no one in the audience was laughing. He clearly wasn't trying to get them to laugh. It was a serious conversation, sets of speeches and Q&A and whatever they were doing. Yeah, which is a fine thing to do. It's just unusual. And I thought an unusually confident thing to do in a way. But then the question came, don't you think it's a bit silly? What's your attitude as an outsider to the fact that like black people can use the N-word and white people can't? And his reply, and the question was somewhat hostile. It was, you know, it was like, I would say it was clear to everyone in the room that the questioner was asking this from the background position that this is a bad rule, that this is somehow a silly rule, that this rule is not good. And, you know, don't you as an outsider agree? And Noah very much, you know, put on his insider voice and basically said, you white people have taken so much away from us that you've come to think that you deserve to have everything.
Right.
And so when there's something, even if it's as small as a word, like you can't weigh it, you can't sell it, it's not making you money, it's not real power, it's just a symbolic token of something. But even that, you feel like you deserve to have that too, because your white mentality gives you a sense of entitlement to all the good things that there is. And what you need to do is get over that white mentality. Like, this is not for you. And every time you hear a black person say the N-word, if you want to say it as well, that's an interesting thing. That does so show that things have changed. If you like want to say it, not because you want to put someone down, but because you're like, that's cool. that is change. And so let's be glad that there's change. But there hasn't been all that much change. And what you need to do in that moment is reflect on how you're wanting to have that thing, but not being able to have it because of how you look, is the daily lived experience of all Black people with so many things that are so much more important than just a word. And so just you having that experience can open a door of empathy into the Black experience that can allow you to, through empathy, understand where people are coming from. And that's the right way. That's the right basis on which to build a better future, is a place of empathy with Black people who have this kind of thing all of the time. And, you know, one of the interesting things about ideas is that, you can, if you put them calmly and you put them eloquently, I think you can see the appeal of bad ideas. And if you put them badly, good ideas can seem really stupid.
Yeah, no, exactly.
So what's the bad idea there? Why is it, if it is a bad idea, to say, as John Blake says, this CNN, you know, columnist who's also a producer of the some of their documentaries, why is it a bad idea to say that, sorry, I just want to pull up the exact quote so that I don't, that America has been held together since World War II by one simple rule, which is a white person would never again be able to publicly use the N-word and not pay the price.
Why is that
a bad rule? Yeah.
I feel like, just as an aside to the larger point you're going to make here, if you think that that's all that's been holding the country together, then the country was lost a very long time ago.
Well, that's the first problem, is that it overestimates the sort of power of the esteem market. And underestimates really important institutional facts that happened since World War II, like some of the legislation ratifying the civil rights movement. You know, I have been critical on this platform and elsewhere about some of that legislation, which sort of basically made a world of capitalism for white Americans and a world of socialism for Black Americans, and the sort of collapse of the housing projects. Has been much more eloquently spoken about by Shelby Steele and much more numerically robustly analyzed by Thomas Sowell than I could reproduce or rehearse. But some of that civil rights legislation did exactly the opposite of what it intended to do, insofar as sort of making life better for
trap people in
dependency, poverty,
the poverty trap.
But some of that civil rights legislation was extremely important.
Oh yeah, I mean, America used to have a whole bunch of states with racial segregation, and where there was a pervasive abusing of people to prevent them from voting and things. And you know, whatever the current talking points are about the return of Jim Crow legislation and electoral reform stuff in the U.S. right now, nothing even close to the horrors inflicted on people in that period is going on now. And that is a big change.
Yeah. And a lot of that had to happen through the law rather than through some sort of civic agreement that we're going to diss people or cancel them or oust them if they use the N-word. So that's one side of it. I think the basic side of it is the basic problem with it is very simple. It's that it's a rule that applies differently to different races. That's that kind of thing is a problem. Here's where it gets interesting though, is, okay, so I say that's the problem. Trevor Noah, everyone, you know, John Blake, they've got their story about why it's a good rule. Here's the interesting question to me. Why does it matter so much to those who defend this rule? So, in other words, Noah's question to this person in the audience was, why does it matter so much to you that you want to say the word? Like, can't you see how small this thing is? Just give me, it's a tiny little thing, give us as Black people one little thing. if you don't want to give us one little thing, like, why does that matter? Why do you particularly want to use that word so much?
Right.
And that so does, if you really,
that you're racist.
Yeah, if you're really itching to say the N-word every day, like, if you're finding yourself saying it every day, and it's not because you're in a skit and you're a stand-up comedian, but, like, every day you find yourself quoting a story, you're like, I'm not saying it myself, I'm just quoting that Witz professor who said it. You know, then I think you probably, you know, then I think Noah's got a good question. Why do you feel like you have to say it so much, whatever the context is? Can't you? Right. What's actually going on here? So I think that's a fair question. And I think that if it turned out that Joe Rogan was saying it all the time, for example, then that would be a serious problem. You know, if it turns out that, like, in his WhatsApp groups, he was constantly calling all of his black friends N-words.
Yes, that would be...
And then some of them weren't down, and he was like, oh, no, I'm not calling you that as in an insulting way. I'm quoting Tupac in the famous album, How's It My N-Word?
Yes, no. If yeah, so...
And that is a real thing. By the way, when I was like 19 years old, I would say there were probably months at a time where I used the N-word every day in South Africa with friends, black and white, who also were using it every day because we were going through a phase. We were listening to American rap music. We all referred to each other as each other's N-words. It was like, and I could see how someone might see that and be like, okay, that's sweet. There's something that you don't know. And honestly, there was something we didn't know. There's something we hadn't internalized. We were operating at the thin, superficial level of like a 50 Cent album.
I think also
the same thing with bitches or B word. You know, you can be, it can go too far. Yeah. Everyone's bitches. It's not nice.
No, agreed.
So you can check something by asking that question. Why do you want to say it all the time?
I think also one of the things that's probably different between now and then is, quite honestly, you probably hadn't experienced it yet in the American context. And I think that kids today going through high school very much experience it in the American context without ever having to go there because I feel like our culture is more intimately connected. But back when you and I was young'uns, especially when you was a young'un because, you know, you're older than me, that quite sort of the way that Americans, they have that visceral reaction to this discussion about the slur.
I grew up with Eminem.
Right.
You know, his albums were dropping. Slim Shady LP when I was 11. Eminem Show when I was like 13. Curtain Call when I was 15. And he and the Dirty Dozen and so on and Dr. Dre. You know, they're collaborating and they're all using this word. So I was imbibing an American context, and I remember watching the Bunny Rat, that Eminem movie. In fact, it's the only movie I ever saw in South Africa where people after the end of the movie stood up and gave a round of applause in Cinema Nouveau.
Which the Eminem movie, what was it called? 8 Mile.
8 Mile. So I had that American context, but it was a very lower class American context / super elite. It wasn't this like upper crust, you know, Ivy League student, CNN anchor, kind of middle class, keeping up with the Joneses. It was not polite society's view. It was the hoodlums with private jets, the hoodlums that were just hoodlums. Yes. So, and part of what changed is that I encountered this American point of view, and I respect that. Like, I don't find myself in the same position that I did when I was 18 and 19 in that regard. Or however old I was, 17. But I think the same question deserves to go to those who say that there should be this rule where it's one thing for white people and one thing for black people. And this is a nice divide, right? You know, there's a series of jokes. There's always been a series of ways, you know, there's two kinds of people in the world. Those who divide the world into two kinds of people.
Yeah. Right.
And I gotta say, I'm in that former category in the sense that I think it's useful to see dichotomies, but always to remember that no dichotomy is the last word, that there's always going to be blurry lines, that you mustn't read too much into them, but they are distinctions are useful. Yes. And much more useful than black and white, I think, is the distinction between people who think that there should be a rule that no white people can use this word and all black people can use this word versus people who think that that rule is silly or that any such rule would be silly. Right. So you might almost say the distinction between racialists and non-racialists. So right. The racialists have to answer the question, why is it such a big deal to have such a rule? And I don't think my argument is that the answers that Trevor Noah gave are, and he's one example, but that is generically the kind of answer that you get, that this answer is never true and it's always known to be untrue by the speaker on serious reflection. And this is the thrust to the argument. If you were to go in a neutral context, right? You put Trevor Noah tomorrow. He hasn't thought about this in a while, or maybe he has because of Joe Rogan. Wait 6 months, put him on a podcast, and you ask him, dude, I've got this rule that would have no actual positive benefit for black people. But symbolically, it would make black people feel like they've got something that white people don't have, and it'll make some white people feel a bit jealous. Do you think that imposing that rule, like, I know what this rule is, I've got it written down, if you agree, I'm going to take it out, and we will find a way to impose this rule, not through the law, but just through shaming people, we can impose this rule whose right. only benefit is to make black people feel better because of some small token symbol. Would you like that rule? Dude, he, Patrice Cullors, Alicia Garza, every serious Stephen Colbert or Colbert,
right.
They would all say that's terrible. That's exactly what politicians have been doing to black Americans for decades. We don't want a merely symbolical token kind of victory. We want housing. We want better jobs. We want whatever. Please don't come with that. That is the last thing that we want. So that's one way that you can tell it's not a serious answer. Here's what I think is a serious answer. I start out from the position, which I've articulated here, that race really is a social construct. That doesn't mean that Nicholas's thick, beautiful black hair, which I'm sure is going to stay on top of his head, very dark brown hair, is going to stay thick and delicious for until he's an old man and it'll go gray before it falls out. That is determined by genetics. It's a phenotypical presentation. Those genetics come from his parents. You can see resemblances and so on and so forth. I'm also, I'm not going to go down all of the list of what it means and doesn't mean, but here's a useful It is so useful if you recognize how what we value about race, what we really value about race when we're talking about race, or what we fear in my case, are artificial values, are values that have been created by conversation rather than by genetics. And if you even if it's just for the sake of argument, because I know a lot of people, even inside the Institute, I get a lot of uphill with this idea. Not in direct confrontation, but I can just see by sort of en passant remarks that I'm not in the majority in South Africa in thinking this way, that's for sure. But if you do just take it on for the sake of argument, what is it that you need to keep an artificial group going, like a soccer club or a country or whatever? Well, you need a label. You need a reliable means of applying that label. That's going to get you some ways along the way. But we've got labels for left-handed people and rules for applying, That's not going to get you all the way. What you really need is a different pattern of behavior, a different set of rules. And every religion has this. It's every religion that I know of on the one hand, has moral rules which apply to all people. Now, sometimes you have to read it into the text a little bit because you really get a very chosen people kind of vibe out of some of the stuff, and it's hard to translate the word person. Like, what does Bantu mean? Does that mean all persons, or does it just mean a category of persons? How did it come to mean that way? Person turns out to be an etymologically very, very confusing word in a lot of languages. But I think it's fair to say that there are universal rules contemplated in sacred texts about truly universal deities. As distinct from that, you have protocols, right? So in Judaism, it's not wrong for Nicholas to eat some bacon. And if it is wrong, it's certainly not wrong in the same way that it would be for our Jewish friend Nikolaevich. He would be doing a very naughty thing as a frum Jew. But for Nicholas to eat the bacon, not such a big deal. However, for Nicholas to murder someone and for Nikolaevich to murder someone, that's both very, very, very wrong. That's both absolutely universally wrong. So you've got these rules that are specifically meant to pick apart groups underneath a layer of rules that are supposed to be universal. That's clearly a huge part of how religions survive.
Right.
You've got to go on Sunday. You've got to wear the cross. You've got to do Ramadan for 40 days. You know, there are all of these protocols indexed to what member of what group.
Pray 5 times a day, give zakat, etc., etc.
If you're a Muslim.
And those rules, by the way, they don't just apply slightly differently in an inclusive sense, as in if you're included in the group, the rule applies to you, and if you're excluded, it doesn't apply to you. They also apply in an exclusive sense, as in you can't go and take the catechism if you have not been baptized after a certain point.
You can't go on the Hajj to Mecca unless you are a Muslim.
They
don't let you into the city.
Literally. This is so these rules are there's an inclusive sense.
There's a sign on the highway that says Muslims, and then there's an arrow, and then it says non-Muslims, and then there's a turn off to turn around.
You know, hell, take a left.
Yeah, pretty much.
But you can't just go and change your mind right now. I mean, maybe you can, and then of course with those rules they'll be like, you know, what's really going on here?
Right.
I've often mentioned the great Catholic line, judge not me and I'll judge not thee. Twixt the stirrup and the ground, mercy I sought and mercy I found. which is the idea, if you're a real Catholic, then you appreciate that all of this other stuff is kind of extra. All you have to do is just before you die, say you're sorry.
Yes, I think that might be somewhat simplifying the theological view of the Catholic Church, but I get your point.
I'm
genuine soulful repentance is the most important tenet. Yeah, no.
And so, so it creates a kind of paradox on how do you resolve that. And if you want to see a good attempt to think about that, the great Catholic writer Ian, I nearly said Ian McEwan. That's totally wrong. Graham Greene, in his book Brighton Rock, gives it a bash. So here's the trouble. So the law has said it's got to be equality before the law. So no rules coming out of the law to say which way goes what.
This whole battle's happening in the esteem mark.
How do you find a rule that you can get most people to agree on that is like the kosher rule or the Mecca journey rule? Or the rule about taking the catechism. Where do you find that rule? What can you possibly do to say, look, here's one way you can tell who's who by how they behave. And the N-word rule is just such an obvious candidate.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Because you're in an environment where unhappy black gangstars have already taken this thing up. As a term of, and this is a very classic, this is the classic esteem move, right? The whole idea of the esteem economy is born from Braithwaite, this Australian criminologist's observations about how criminal culture works, and that criminals are so alienated, they are so deprived from esteem from the community. It's so hard for them to get likes because they've been jailed, they've been shamed, they've been blamed. So how do they get likes? They end up taking the terms of shame and blame,
right,
and saying, I'm using this on you because we belong to a club, and that club is what makes us special. And that club then, immediately as soon as you have a club, you get a hierarchy. And so some people get to be more badass.
This is exactly like when you first explained the esteem market to me, I remembered the way that people behave on certain online image boards, for example. Like the one that came to mind was the notorious image board called 4chan, where people, especially in the sort of heyday of that website, would actively praise immoral actions or chaotic actions or destructive actions because they often felt like they were deprived of, you know, we're all losers, we're all weird, none of us have girlfriends. And so what really matters here is that we flip the whole way.
None of us have girlfriends turns out to be the preface to like every really, really awful thing that's ever happened.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. I think actually Kevin Williamson wrote about that once. But anyway, regardless, it was exactly the same concept as happens in prisons, except instead of, you know, shanking someone in the showers and dealing drugs, it was about, can I make people upset at someone's funeral? Can I ruin a funeral? Can I do this other horrible prank on people? Like, just nasty things, but this was praised, and it was seen as a sort of way almost of striking back against the, you know, the society that never loved us enough. Very like, what's the word? Sort of, it's kind of like an ideology of feeling sorry for yourself.
Well, it's a very lizard brain response. It's a little bit like, you know, when a heroin addict steals his mother's jewelry to go and buy more heroin. In some sense, it's profoundly unmysterious. Like, it's so terrible, and you know that that person, if he ever sobers up, is going to be so much remorse, and it's like so much. There's a lot to it that's like unnatural, I guess, is one word I'm tempted to use. Not that the natural is good or bad, but it's a kind of thing that sets a level of expectation. It seems so surprising that people time and again will chase likes by behaving in explicitly shameful ways, creating a counterculture around that shameful behavior. But that just turns out to be...
One could argue that someone like Kim Kardashian, in a sense, started her career.
Yeah, with the porno.
With the sex tape. And also with being very obviously about the material, sort of flashy, shallow life.
Yes, her and Paris Hilton.
Yes. I must say I'm much more fond of Paris Hilton than Kim Kardashian. I think Paris Hilton is one of America's greatest business people, but in a way that Kim Kardashian's not, but that's not a discussion for now.
That's a hot take. I'm kind of curious to know more there.
Yeah, we'll get there another time. Just remind me.
Okay, I'll remind you another time. So back to the headline sort of claim that the reason this really matters is because it becomes a rule. I'm not saying that's how it started, and I'm certainly not saying that people artificially and deliberately – there was no smoke-filled cigar room where people said, hey, how are we going to keep like racial divides super salient, especially in ways that will, you know, benefit extremists in both the Republican and Democratic parties and will drive up a fiscal deficit nightmare that'll make life really good for rich bankers and other people who sort of just win every time the government misspends money and will be really damaging in the long run to like poor working class Americans and Americans won't be able to solve or see this problem, or if they do, they'll be distracted the next time, you know, a stand-up comedian does a basic routine in which
you spend a lot of time on Facebook or wherever. You'll find that the prevailing view is people laying out all these facts and saying, and you see this proof that there is someone behind it, that there was a meeting.
Yes. There was no meaning. The SD market, it's the intangible hand. This is why it's so clever that they use the intangible hand motif to describe the SD market's movements in much the way that the invisible hand describes basic forces of supply and demand, creating dynamic equilibria, which, while not perfectly, do at least somewhat represent, you know, what people prefer. Sort of pineapples cost more than potatoes because people don't want them as much, actually, and they're harder to grow and all kinds of things. But when they want them for a treat, so they don't mind it being a bit extra, and so that's where the sort of market price gets found for it. On the demand side, something like that is there's no coordination for setting those prices. There's no coordination for setting these things, but it's no surprise looking in the back mirror how it turned out to be like this, because you had a sort of underclass pushback appropriating the N-word since the 1900s. And when there was every reason to be fully rebellious and Spartacus about this. And then it required or would have required lots more shocks. Well, not lots more. I mean, so many shocks in the right direction happened to dissolve this. But as it turns out, it just wasn't enough to break this rule. In fact, this rule got reinforced by a coalition of gangstars and of sort of white guilt esteemed players who felt very special about themselves, because they could reinforce this rule and they could say, look, I, as a white person, have had a better life and I'm more powerful and I'm more amazing than like 20% of the population just because I'm white, but I'm also more powerful and more amazing than the sort of 60% that's white, because unlike them, I'm willing to beat my breast in public and say that I'm terrible. So I'm kind of better than black people because of my white privilege, and I'm better than white people because of my denunciation of myself.
The bottom line is, you get the everyone.
white guilt is the best guilt, and guilt is the highest virtue. Therein lies the sort of modus operandi of the white burden supremacist. And they turned out to have really disproportionate esteem clout for various reasons. Okay, so that's my theory. And I think that the desperation of this piece in trying to, I mean, if someone wants to criticize Joe Rogan, if you're curious, by the way, I happened to see these pieces before the Fandango, the stand-up pieces, where he basically says, you know, here's the joke. Joe Rogan's basic joke is like, I wish I could say that. But when I'm not on stage, I sort of, I can joke about it now, but it's kind of hilarious that like, it's a cool word that I want to be able to use. So this is a very benign sort of way to make a joke about it. The fact that someone's trying to make that out to be as dangerous as a potential disruption of the peaceful transfer of power between two presidents, as dangerous as murder and death in other riots. I mean, I think that the key is to believe that person when he's saying what he's saying. That has got to be, you know, I think the single most important lesson from George Orwell, especially when it comes to racialists. If a racialist, if John Blake is telling you that he is as afraid of this rule going away as he is of a coup, you should believe him. I think there's a tempting kind of sort of play racist attitude, reason not to believe this kind of racialist stuff. You know, it's like, no one can really be serious. Believe someone when they say that. And it makes sense. It coheres with sort of a larger worldview. And as far as I can make out from reading a few headlines, I mean, the other headline we saw was like America's new biggest threat, racism without racists. This is this guy's worldview, and you should take it seriously. And it's a lot of Americans' worldview. This is a, you know, top influence or tastemaker at America's most left-wing respected news platform, played in airports around the world. This guy thinks that the rule, the social practice that just divides by behavior black people from white people, he thinks that breaking that rule down is just about the worst thing you can imagine. And right. I have got a theory for why. And that's because if that rule were to break down in one of two ways, either this becomes, as I think it should be, like in South Africa with a K word, no one says this thing unless there's an especially good reason. And especially good reasons never include using it to insult someone. Especially good reasons do include quotation, novels, theatrical spectacles, stand-up comedy can be fair game. You know, artistic, there's a sort of cordon sanitaire around the artistic arena where you can't make rules about what words can and can't be used, because precisely what happens within that cordon sanitaire is a subversion and a recapitulation of words in ways that you couldn't even have imagined before when you were trying to make up the rules, because artists are more creative when all things are going well than lawmakers or rule makers, even if they're just esteemed rulemakers. But outside of that, it's not on. That's one rule. The other rule would be, okay, this is fine for everyone. This thing has totally been denuded of its original thing. In either event, I don't have much of a dog in the fight. I really would prefer the first version of just like everyone kind of drop it a little bit. The rap stars can still sing it. The thespians can still use it. But the stand-up comedians can still say it. But, and this rule is much like in the world today, excepting that in classrooms in America, teachers would not tolerate black students calling each other N-word. That's really where the change would come. In the same way that they don't tolerate white students saying it. And there are, of course, some cases. In fact, one of the few N-word sort of hate speech cases, pseudo hate speech cases, because America doesn't quite have hate speech, but it's got something like it, was about a black person using the N-word against an employee. And he was sued for defamation, and it was successful. So the law understands where I'm coming from. People could come up with a different modus vivendi where it's like, well, anyone can say it anytime. I've got less hope for that, but whatever, either way, the big victory would be that there is one less behavior to distinguish people by race. And I think it's really only those behaviors, that keep the race thing alive in the way that's toxic. Of course, people will always notice that some people look different, and there will always be some sort of historical football fan type, you know, silliness. But I think that's a huge thing. And so that would completely undermine like thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people's career. Like if race was no longer a big, bad deal. The IRR could pack up their stuff and go home, but we're the one race-based institution, or like, you know, race relations just think tank, that I think would be pretty happy to.
Yeah, I think a lot of others would be very shocked at this.
And so that's why it matters so much to him, because it would end his world. It would end his job. He wouldn't know what – it would be like losing his religion.
Right. So I have a number of takes on this. One is just the idea of racial ownership makes my skin crawl. It just feels like a completely wrong idea that a race can own something. A race is not a person. A race is not a like proper organization. It's not a thing that can have legal standing. So we shouldn't ever treat a race as though it owns something. But also, I want to go at this from a different, completely different angle, which is my fear, and maybe you don't agree with me, that far too much of politics, particularly in the US, and this is what people often call the culture wars, is entirely a battle about esteem while no one actually talks about policy. And the result of this is that what comedians say, what TV show hosts say, what basically the esteem market, I don't know what to call them, the priests, the high priests of the esteem market do.
Yeah.
Is vastly more important than anything else. And this is one of the things that frustrates me so much about modern politics, is it seems as though no one gives a damn anymore about what the law is, and we only care about esteem. And I think it's profoundly toxic, because obviously esteem is important sometimes. I mean, in the South, in the US, right? It was very important to change the esteem market there because the esteem market was discriminatory against Black Americans.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you can't abandon everything else to just constantly argue about which words are okay, who gets taught what in a certain position, who gets the top show on some TV station, whether this comedian said a good word or told a funny joke or not. It drives me insane. And there is no resolution to these things because they are all esteem market battles. What do you think of that?
Ah, okay. I think you were right up until the end.
Okay.
So,
what was I wrong?
So back in the day, there really was a very serious disagreement about, you know, whether a Black person would be able to operate something like a machine gun or an aeroplane.
Right.
And that's just not a debate anymore.
Right.
So the esteem market really can change. So it's not just that the American military had these pressures and they had Black regiments and white regiments and then some mixed regiments and then finally some pressure forced them nominally to change the rules so that they could have Black operators of some of the most expensive and lethal material known to man.
Right. So
it's also the case. People were like, no, right. Man, that's why so let me ever exclude someone. So you can have changes.
That's what I was trying to say. Yeah. It's that not that there aren't ever changes in the esteem market, because as you point out, there very definitely are, but that none of the current fights that we seem to have a resolution, to my mind.
Okay. So here's
why
2 points.
The culture wars go on forever.
So 2 points. The one point is, I wonder if it's ever been all that different. I mean, you and I are in the think tank policy space. So I definitely feel sort of as I'm getting a little bit older, I think the thing that makes me feel the most old is that sense that really important policy debates don't sustain themselves. Like, we can find moments where we pierce through and we get some sunshine and people kind of care about policy talk, but the snap back to talking about personalities and esteem, you know, having clashes about what the esteem norms should be, that's just so quick. And it's disheartening. But sometimes I try and look back in history and I think, is it all that different? If you go back a few hundred years to before sort of constitutional democracies or well-ordered, reason-responsive, democratically sensitive governance, I think that you see, okay, you know, a caricature of the smoke-filled cigar rooms or whatever the sort of inner sanctum looks like, where people like us and actual politicians kind of, we try and influence them directly and they make the rules and the plebs kind of are mainly watching Punch and Judy in the streets. And sometimes there is a political inflection and sometimes the sort of battle of ideas or the esteem forces really get very ruckus and you can have like the 30 Years' War, you can have, you know, Catholics versus Protestants, and that seems to be what it's about. And then the powers that be, Catholics end up aligning with Protestants, and then the plebs are kind of like, you know, I thought we were fighting Catholics versus Protestants, love. Turns out we're just fighting, you know, or this one versus that one. You know, so they can get disaffected, or they can double down on their zealotry, and you can have actual conspiracies and far-out conspiracy theories and lots of magical thinking. But so there's clearly a disconnect between what's going on in the ground level and what's going on in the corridors of power. And notwithstanding that disconnect, there is some kind of feedback loop between the two. So I think part of what democracy does is bring those two levels closer to each other. So that things don't have to get all the way to like a peasant pitchfork revolt before you get a change yes. of power.
Whereas the Byzantines did it, a riot in the Hippodrome.
Yes. Which is really scary because sometimes they take horses that would poo on the tiles and then get very slippery. For the like horse poo so, tile, not.
But
this is the background to the 2 points, and the 2 points are much quicker than the background. The 2 points are one, as it gets closer and closer, it can, in some senses, be more frustrating. But I think the basic truth is something like this. Insofar as politics is going wrong in a constitutional democracy, the underlying, if it's going long for a sustained period for like decades, then I think the explanation has got to be that there's something about the distribution of esteem that's not working. And then the thought, the sort of esteem revolutionaries thought, and I kind of came to this as an esteem revolutionary, is like that's where we need to make the change. So it really does matter that we win these conversations. It really does matter in South Africa that Helen Ziller's sort of thing about colonialism, you know, that was an esteem move, right? She wants to say,
yes,
here's a norm. You never say anything nice about colonialism's legacy. Here's another norm. You see the bad and the good. I really believe that is an essential ingredient to our politics getting sorted out. Because it's no surprise to me that Eskom went through the floor. It's no surprise to me that our railway lines have been stripped and sold off and that the remainder has been turned into squatter camps. Because those are colonialism's legacy and you're not allowed to talk about anything good about them. It's no surprise and so on and so forth. So on the other hand, if we did get non-racialism, which is most South African, 80% of South Africans want jobs appointed on merit, 80% would prefer vouchers to BEE, 80% say they've experienced no racism personally in the last 5 years. If those values could just become the public values, if they could set the tone for ENCA and SABC and Newsroom Africa and Daily Friend.
No, I agree with you completely. Things would be very different.
That connection would make our bureaucracy much more efficient, and that would mean that poor people that are living really, really cuck lives would have a much better chance of living really, really good lives. So that's why I want to fight that fight. Now, the second point is that the fight never will end. We'll never have a perfect esteem market, and that's why we need guys like you to say, look, at this stage, you're getting lost in that fight. And what you really need to do is just make things work. Go and administer, go make the potholes fixed up, make the lights
work. I think one of the problems here, and I agree with you completely about, esteem market problems are a big problem in South Africa. And I think, they are also a problem in the US for some of the same reasons. And in fact,
Trump and Biden.
Part of the problems. But I guess my point here is a sort of deeper dissatisfaction with the way that esteem market fights go. And I guess this is kind of really what gets under my skin. It feels like what's happening, particularly in the US, but also even in South Africa a bit, is that you've almost got like a sort of a play that plays out with esteem market battles. That feels very sort of cynical and like everyone's got to say and do a certain thing. It's a sort of, it's almost like a contentless action reaction sort of thing. And I mean, I've been cynically joking recently that, the Republican Party in the US at this point is nothing but a vehicle for selling mattresses. That's because so many of the culture warrior figures, they survive off of advertising and people are drawn to their shows and the people who advertise with them are mattress companies.
Yeah, and it's the soap opera, the whole reason for a soap opera is to sell soap.
Exactly. And so it isn't even really about an esteem market fight anymore. What it is about is a soap opera to sort of keep everyone entertained while, to pretend like we still there's some great crisis that's about to hit everything without talking about the actual great crises that are out there. Like, for example, the deficit in the US, which, kind of sort of grows and money continues to be spent recklessly by both parties. And it's sort of a vague talking point, but no one takes it particularly seriously. And their big social programs like Social Security and stuff are going bust in a couple of years, which will have significant social impact.
It's going to be very hard for the rest of the world. Yeah.
And but instead, it's sort of like...
Instead we're talking about whether... No, but here's the pushback argument.
Hmm.
So in a lot of ways, the fiscal deficit in the US, the printing of money. I had a very interesting series of discussions towards the end of this week with some sort of, you know, I don't know, bankers and such like. And they're saying what I think we've been agreeing about for quite a while, although, boy, has it gotten worse. Like, there's a kind of bust that's already baked in.
Right.
So it's the
war. Because everyone's been scared of it for so long.
Yeah. So it'll come, and you can't really avoid it. So now the question is, not so much can you avoid it. The question is, can you survive it? Can you come out of it better or worse? Can you learn the lessons from the harsh hangover that's going to come the next day? Or come hangover day? You know, what happens? And this was like a Slavoj Žižek point, this sort of neo-Marxist, anti-Marxist guy who suffered in the Balkans, under that terrible regime, but acts as a clown. Anyway, he said, you know, V for Vendetta is the perfect movie to encapsulate how too many people think about politics. It's everything about how do you build up to the revolution. Okay, now you've got like half of London wearing funny masks outside of Parliament, striking midnight. You've overthrown the regime. He said in his funny accent, "I want to see what happened the next day." And that's what I want to see. You know, that's where the esteem battle matters most, is like Dr. Franz Kronier's thesis, is what happens the next day after the crisis. Yes. Because if we go into that fiscal crisis with this CNN idea, it's a very different outcome.
My favorite example of this was an interviewer who was talking to a dedicated member of the Islamic State, hardline Islamist, totally on board with killing infidels, wants to establish the great global caliphate that rules over all of humanity. And the question that was asked of him was, but what does refuse collection look like in the caliphate?
Exactly.
And it will not surprise you to learn that, well, you know, I'm more of an ideas guy. We haven't really thought that far. That kind of thing will sort itself out. These are the answers that were given.
And by the way, those might be fine answers. You might have a theory as a constitutional drafter. You know, John Adams and Jefferson and Hamilton and company didn't necessarily have a good answer to that question, what do you do about refuse collection? But they did have a very serious – they did really try to think through what it needs to happen after the revolution to secure the peace in a sustainable and growing fashion. And, you know, Washington was a great guy. He got his army together and he got very practical. And Adams was a great guy. He was sort of arguing we need to send guns with flints that actually light up rather than the damp, useless things to Massachusetts. Because, you know, at a practical level, if the flint doesn't light, the bullet don't shoot. So, you know, we're not going to get anywhere if we don't hold off the siege in Boston and so on. And that's important work, but there also really is very important work being done by Franklin and Jefferson in terms of trying to think and talk and convince people about some of the basics of what we need. And it was like a big esteem, you know, the insofar as the separation between church and state was baked into the American Constitution. My reading, which is not very deep, but I have, but there's some of it, is that this felt like an esteem, this felt like a bit of an esteem revolution. And it felt important and it felt hard to convince people. And it felt like if we can just stop fighting about which sect of the church is supposed to be the official one, if we can just stop fighting about that, then we'll be much better at solving problems like refuse collection. Now, I'm sure the caliphate guy would say the same thing. If we could only figure out, maybe I mustn't do accents. We could only figure out.
It sounds more Slavic than
slightly walk nose Slavic.
What was funny about this one is he almost certainly would have had a British accent because I think he was one of those sort of foreign jihadis who had gone on jihad tourism. But
brilliant. So as soon as we bring the law in line with the Quran, of course we will enable ourselves to answer such bureaucratic and administrative questions to the best of any human's ability. For we will walk in Sharia the law, Sharia.
And my counter would be, you know, Sharia law is pretty comprehensive, but it doesn't really cover how to you know, actually like run things.
My point is precisely about the distinction between a constitution, a law, and a bylaw. And I'm saying when esteem market revolutions matter, it's like changing the constitution. It doesn't directly solve the law and the bylaw problems, but it sets a framework within which those problems are much easier to solve. If you've got an efficient and effective esteem distribution, if we just stopped fighting about whether it's a good idea to have different rules for black and white people, and then we would have more oxygen to fight about the important things like what's the right thing to do with the next $4 trillion that gets invented by the Fed. And in that environment, you wouldn't spend the next $4 trillion. Presumably, that's my point of view. So that's why I think that it's important to note that there will never be a final esteem revolution. In that sense, it's like there'll never be a final new company with a great idea. There'll always be a next one and a next one. There'll always be a new party to compete or a new candidate. These things do never end. And so at some stage, we all get too tired or too dead to keep up with the onward rush of humankind. But at the same time, there are distinct victories and losses. There really are moments where the esteem market is shocked so clearly in a certain direction that it does predetermine what answers are not available to future political questions. And where those esteem debates are then also off the cards. There just is no one in Germany. There's not a serious person in Germany, not even a semi-serious person in Germany, who's debating the Jewish question. Now, if you go back 100 years, dude, that's going to sound like a ridiculous proposition. You say in 1935, let me tell you, one day this, I'm not saying that one side's going to win the debate, but the debate's like this debate is literally going to be over. Okay. The Jewish question is not going to affect the chancellor election, it's not going to affect the tax rate question, it's not going to affect social services questions, it's not going to be a talking point even for rhetorical purposes. They're going to say you're a madman. Things do change. Esteem victories can be won. I think what's frustrated is that en route, it does feel like high theater, just as you said, man. It just feels so predetermined because, I mean, of course it's predetermined. And yet, you know, I've got a friend I've mentioned before who worked for six years as a teacher in a prison, in a pretty high security prison in New York State. You know, most of those conversations were predetermined. Because most of those conversations are like, do this, nah, yeah, blah, blah, blah. No, but you got to do this, otherwise you don't get the high school diploma that you need to get like a decent job. You're just going to go back and you're going to be a criminal. Nah. You know, it's a lot of life is pretty obvious. And I do think that it's easy to lose one's confidence, like in the thought that, okay, I keep repeating myself, so maybe that means I'm talking just as much rubbish as the other person. but I don't think it's true, and I don't think it's fair. And I think what is true, and I think what is fair to say, is that there is a right and there's a wrong idea about this. And as there were in previous matters, like whether America's going to be better off if it sort of chooses one sect to be its official religion. There's a right and there's a wrong answer to that question. And they gave the right answer. And then it won. And now it's hardly a debate insofar as there are religious separation of church and state issue. It's like a very different kind of issue.
Right. So there's something else that actually
there's a case for hope.
Yeah, there's a case for hope. The audacity of hope. I should have mentioned this much earlier in the discussion, but remember you said that this is factually untrue. Our writer here, what's his name? Blake.
John Blake.
John Blake. John Black starts off by saying no one has ever gotten, you know, gotten away with saying the N-word and continued on with their career, you know, in public life. That's actually not true. There is another example beyond the Louis C.K. one, and that is, have you ever heard of Dwayne Chapman?
Go on.
Better known as The Dog.
Go on even further.
He's an American celebrity who, let's just say, people at the New York Times don't watch. But for a time, I think had a little bit of quite a burst in popularity, enough so to make him parodied on South Park. But Dwayne Chapman is a former criminal. He was convicted of being an accessory to murder. Well, I think he was convicted of murder, but it's because he was an accessory, not because he did the murder. It was something to do with the Texas law at the time. But anyway, he got convicted of this. He becomes very religious, leaves prison, and then goes on to become a bounty hunter, where he basically catches people who are skipping court, their court date, right? That's what he does for money. He goes and he finds people who have taken bond money, bail money, and then just run away and not showed up at court. So he ended up getting on TV somehow. He had a sort of big explosion of popularity. He got given a TV series called Dog the Bounty Hunter, which was basically like the trifecta of all the things that make reality TV show good. It was the Jerry Springer Show plus Cops plus, you know, WWE wrestling, all kind of together. 2007, he's at the height of his fame and popularity. A leaked recording comes out of a phone conversation between him and his son, where he says he's complaining about his son's girlfriend. And he said, I don't care if she's a Mexican, a whore, or whatever. It's not because she's black. It's because we use the word, and then he says the word, but I'm going to say N-word sometimes here. I'm not going to take a chance ever in life of losing everything I've worked for 30 years because some F N-word hears us say N-word and turned us into the Inquirer magazine. Our career is over. I'm not taking that chance at all. Never in life, never, never. And then he basically tells her to break up with his girlfriend. So there's a lot of weird stuff going on here. But before we get into that, he took a hiatus from the show for like a month, went on to have it, got it renewed for 5 years after that, and then continued to have a career. I think his show might still be running, the sequel to it, which is Dogs Most Wanted is the current iteration of it. Now, look, he isn't a high society here, but Dog wasn't really affected by being caught on camera using the N-word in a much dodgier context than a comedian doing a show. And America has not collapsed.
So that's a very good example, because it brings out another point, which I think is kind of disparaging, tragic, and true. There's something strange about stand-up comedy, which is that, I mean, stand-up comedy is theater. Like, if the proposition is white people can't use the N-word in theater or in cinema or in music, then this is just like in live performance or in recorded performance. This is just completely bonkers. Like, you know, you can't, like, Crash won a an Oscar. And like
Nobel Prize for acting, I like that idea.
And it was like definitely no, but it's like seriously, anytime, you know, The Wire, David Simon, sort of arguably greatest TV show ever created. Let me tell you, David Simon wrote all of the lyrics to that TV show. What do you call them? Words, script. I'm mixing these things up because they all belong within one universe, which is the universe of the arts. Now, stand-up comedy is, in a sense, the most... I think it might be fair to say that stand-up is the latest truly genre-defying development in mainstream arts. Right? It came after, you know, if you think, what were the big moves in the 20th century? Well, someone had the idea of like putting a urinal in the middle of an art gallery. And ever since then, we've had this thing called installation art or, you know, found objects and so on. That was a new idea. Like, no one had done that before. Everyone before had either painted or sculpted something before they put it in an art gallery. This guy, then dudes were like masturbating in the art gallery and like recording the sounds of it, and that became art. That was new. That was original. Jackson Pollock stood on top of paintings and just slashed them with paint, and you had this abstract expressionist thing. It's more dodgy. There's some stuff in the 1600s you might, but really, to be fair, it's new. It was an original idea. Cubism was an original idea. There have been these original ideas. In theater, I would say there's a chance that the only thing to succeed stand-up comedy as a format of theater is the sort of in-situ theatrical productions. Like Sleep No More was the biggest deal in New York when I was staying there, where you go into a hotel room, you go into a hotel, and the whole hotel is the theatrical space. And some of the stuff you see together as an audience in the foyer, and some of the stuff you'll be led off into individual rooms, and you'll get a little performance just you two, and you got to run around there. So it's kind of like choose your own adventure. I don't know that anyone was doing theater like that in Shakespeare's day. Sleep No More is a rehash of Macbeth. And there's just, I don't think anyone watched Macbeth in such a fashion where you get split up from the rest of the audience and spend some of the time.
But,
so there are these genre-defining things, and that might have come later than stand-up. I'm not sure. It depends on your view of Eastern European theater and how much it counts as being part of the world. Many people don't think that Eastern Europe or Russia belong to the world.
They
belong
here to we an go alien again. Population. Let's stay away from that.
But the point is that Grotowski's Poor Theater is kind of a presage to stand-up comedy, as is the sort of performative delivery of beat poetry in the first hipster era, just after World War II. And it's sort of out of this, as far as I can tell, and vaudeville, that stand-up comedy emerges. But it's different to all of those things because precisely of how much more straight it is. Vaudeville, you know, you'd have a guy who'd come and stand up and tell jokes for a while, but there'd be one-liners and there'd literally be a drum kit going dum-ch and stuff like that. Right? We still recognize that, but you've never heard that. You have never heard a professional stand-up routine with dum-ch the whole time. And if you have, it's because you went on YouTube and you saw stuff from the 70s. So it is an original genre. And to complete Philistines, I can understand why it doesn't look like art. For the same reasons that Philistines thought that Grotowski wasn't art, for the same reason that Philistines thought that mimetic painting or abstract expressionism or found objects or Michel Duchamp, every time there's a genuine elaboration of artistic space and practice and genre behavior, there's some idiot who says that's not art. Because I could do it. And it doesn't look like art, because art looks like all those other things that came before. And so art can never change. It's a conservative impulse, and it's one of the places where, you know, conservative is a sort of stupid thing to be. And the great irony is that the great conservatives, the people who mistake stand-up comedy for art, are... I mean, confuse stand-up comedy for politics rather than art, are basically the American left or the American radical left. Because they do – this guy doesn't think of Joe Rogan as belonging – Joe Rogan's stand-up skit as belonging to the same category that you just described, a sort of a private conversation between a father and a son. That's what makes it so much more dodgy.
I mean, yes.
That and the fact that he's trying to exclude people. But to start, if exactly that same series of words was in a play, the playwright would be in no trouble at all, or should be in no trouble at all, because it's a play, or it's a movie about racism.
Right.
You can't do that movie without this. But they don't think of stand-up comedy as being like a movie. They think of it as being like CNN.
Yes.
And no, this exactly is a guy who works at CNN. He thinks it's the same. He doesn't see the cordon sanitaire, the stripping, hard dividing line between the art world where everything's allowed. And I don't know this for sure, but from the corner of my eye, it strikes me as very plausible that he mistakes it for the same reason that so many people, unfortunately, at CNN have mistaken it. And that's that they think of Colbert and Trevor Noah and Jon Stewart as the news. And that's where I agree with
you. Performance.
on the nightmare of the Esteem Games that it's been taken too seriously. The fact that stand-up comedians are as politically significant as they are, I think is a symptom of how badly stupid elite media practitioners in America are.
Right.
They don't have to do that. And they don't have to do that to chase clicks. They can chase clicks like the Daily Mail, you know? The Daily Mail chases clicks by putting, what did I see today? They said 10, you know, 10 sex positions and how many calories they'll burn for the build up to Valentine's Day.
Or it's always on the sidebar. It's never in the front headline. But it's always very visible, and it's like some celebrity who you probably haven't heard of before in a thong bikini on the beach. That's the other way they chase clicks.
Okay, so, and it doesn't just have to be objectifying women. There's a lot of ways. There's a lot of like ways of saying, look, here we're going to be lowbrow. Here we're going to cover the entertainment scene. We can do like cooking. We can whatever. There's like a million different ways. Right. Crossword puzzles. New York Times still has great crossword puzzles, and their purchase of Wordle has not chased away the market. That kind of stuff is super duper duper. Let the news exist within a broader realm that includes a bit of entertainment. That is fine, but don't confuse entertainment for the news.
Right.
You've made a cardinal error.
It's very good at determining the difference between the tabloid section and the news.
Yeah, people can do it.
We do it very well all the time. This example is crazy because I mean he literally says because we say racist words, I don't want you to have a black girlfriend because if she hears us saying racist things, then we might get in trouble and lose our careers.
No, dude, that is. I mean, so what's interesting about that case is it does remind me of. So. Here I'll take on a slightly less confident note.
No.
I'm very bothered by sort of secondhand racism. So this title, Racism Without Racists, that's absurd. That is absurd on its face. But here's what's not absurd. Consider the following thought experiment. You have a society where one person is a taste-based racist. Okay, right. So that means he would spend an extra $1 million to have no white neighbors or no black neighbors or no Asian neighbors or no whatever right. You want to pick your race. But it's to his taste. Like in the same way that you will spend extra money for a better computer game that you like more, that he'll spend more money on that.
Super okay. Awesome RGB keyboard.
Yes, super. Okay, so he'll do that. And so the people who are running the restaurants, and you've got and the race that he doesn't like is a small race, and it's got a small share of the society's wealth and income. So then you've got some guys who are like, well, if I let people of the race he doesn't like in to my restaurant, he'll never come to my restaurant.
And so I move out on his business, and therefore I'm going
to... And that's worth more to me. So I will adopt... I'm not a racist. I kind of, you know, every now and then I actually take some of the extra money that I'm making and I give it to the Institute of Race Relations because I think indirectly that might convince him to stop being such an idiot. You know, I really, really don't like what he's doing, but, you know, I need the extra. It's going to double my money to go this way rather than that way, and I need that extra money to send my kids to school. And so, the next set of restaurants further around in the periphery are like, well, we've noticed that a lot of people have taken on this restaurant practice, and as a result, a lot of people have developed this affinity for these kinds of restaurants. So now there is a statistical discrimination. Where people will say a good restaurant will have this rule,
racist. Right.
And a bad restaurant won't have that rule because they're the ones that are making half as much money, and so they don't clean their dishes very well and whatever. And so we want to be in the upper part of the market, so we go for racist rules. And some other guy says, you know, I've read The Long Tail, I don't want to make a lot of money out of one restaurant. I want to make a little bit of money out of a lot of restaurants, and that's going to do me even better. So he becomes like a slum lord and a slum restaurant chain owner, and those restaurants are totally free for anyone to come, but they are by design very poorly run and very dirty and very messy and not particularly healthy, and they all that kind of stuff. So that then reinforces the statistical discrimination. So you've got one person with taste-based discrimination, which is the hardcore pure sense of racism. Then you've got a network around that person who have strategic behaviors to appease racists. And then on the third wider rim that kind of ends up spanning everything and reinforcing, you've got statistical discrimination, where race just does become a good proxy for judging all kinds of things. If there's a neighborhood that includes that race, you can be sure property values are depressed. If you've got a neighborhood that excludes that group, those property values are higher and will continue to grow. The same for restaurants, the same for goods and services.
Right, this is the point where the sort of workistas kind of try to say, you know, this is one of the things they base their arguments about modern racism on.
Well, so I'm saying you can't have racism without racists. But I'm saying you can have a whole racist society just with one racist. In the way that
if he's super influential. Yeah.
And in the absence of him, one dude, you could just have one law. You could have one law that says, you know, people of this race are not allowed this job, or they're not allowed, you know, something to really disesteem that race. That could set up the strategic, you know, some people will take that in earnest, and they'll become taste-based racists, because they'll be like, the country's right, so I'm, you know, people can develop distastes. In fact, one of the things in the literature, and there was a Princeton scientist, a social scientist who found this, you know, it's like amazing how quickly people will change their minds about their racial tastes and distastes. Even their, like that visceral taboo, that same guy who couldn't say it, dude, you wouldn't have to do much. You know, give me like a long weekend, a team building exercise with people of different races, and we can get that guy saying N-word Joe Rogan jokes very easily. Unfortunately, you can also get guys, you know, actually using the word in a ugly, tasteful, like in a really hateful way very easily. People are not as robust as just as a matter of social science. It turns out, unfortunately, that we're not as robust as we try to take ourselves to be, which is one of the reasons that it's nice to have some people around who try and comb the hair through and get rid of the nits that can accumulate of bad thinking about race. And I guess that's part of what we try to do. But anyway, my point is that this conversation you've described, where the guy says to his son, dude, I want you to break up with your girlfriend. I've got no problem with black people, but in our family, we've got this habit of using this word in this way that we know to mean something, but that can easily be recorded, taken out of context, and ruin our careers. That feels like a strategic or a secondhand kind of racism. So he's not personally – I don't feel like I need to doubt his earnestness. And that kind of racism – dude, I know that kind of racism very well. If racism is the right word, because my mother lives in the center of Johannesburg, and the reason her house is worth as little as it is not entirely, but in part because of secondhand racism, because of people moving out of central Joburg when black people moved in, really not because they didn't like black people, but because they were afraid of what that would do to their housing value because of what other people would think about black people moving in. And my mom didn't have that for whatever reason, didn't have that impulse to change her behavior. And maybe part of it is the artistic tick. Not to, you know, someone goes and watches a movie or a play and they tell you you say, what did you think about it? And they say, I think someone who's like this might be offended. Like, then you know that person knows nothing about the joy and the tragedy of true artistic experience. You don't look through someone else's eyes. You don't report someone else's experience. You report your own experience. You don't live according to someone else's prejudices or mores. You do your own thing. That is a warrior code. that in our society tends to manifest more in the arts than in politics. I'm extemporizing about that. I don't know if that has anything to do with my mom's decision or whatever. I'll leave that to her. But I do think that one thing that the woke guys like to talk about that I wish we talked about more was that in-between space where someone is not personally prejudiced, but they are having detrimental effects because of strategic or statistical forms of discrimination. In this instance, I think it's pretty simple to say what the problem is, just at a pragmatic level. Like if I was the son, I would say, Dad, you're a raging idiot. That would be much more dangerous if she was white and went to Yale. Like you should be... You should be asking me where she went to university. You should be asking me what job she does. Her race is really not going to be a good predictor of this. In fact, it might even go the other way, like, because there'll be a conversation and a confrontation. We'll get over it. If she's like a sneaky white social justice warrior. And maybe given the fact that his career, like he made it, maybe that's why. Like maybe if...
He did the whole thing that America does expect of someone who has been caught, you know, using a racial slur, which is he did the whole meeting with, people who are described as leaders of the black community and, you know, kind of giving public penance, that kind of thing, which is all, I think, appropriate, at least to a certain extent. But,
No, man, you must go and apologize to the sort of the social, you must go and apologize to all the white people at the New School in New York.
Well, I think part of it is, of course, this guy also was someone who sort of tried to hold himself up as a role model of sorts, right? His whole story is that he was the criminal who learned from his bad life. And now he was this exemplary guy who had turned his life around, and he was a tough guy who went out there to take down bad guys. Interestingly, he's not allowed to use firearms because he is a convicted felon. And as a result, he only uses beanbags, beanbag guns and pellet guns, paintball guns to take down criminals, which makes the show very exciting because lots of people get shot, but no one ever gets killed.
So it's kind of a good ending. I mean, so he was being a bad person. He was doing a bad thing, and he got some kind of punishment. So
it's not reintegration. Really,
yeah,
the punishment so much that I think was, you know, I crawl at the idea that there's such a thing as a leader of the black community. But I do think that it's important that in certain circumstances that we do have this kind of public, you know, this is a thing where, as anti-Twitter as I am, and we've had arguments about this before, I do think that there is space to publicly shame and do penance of a sort. It's just that it can go too far. as it often does these days, or it often gets so unhinged from reality that it just becomes stupid.
Okay, so it's kind of, I like that. It's a kind of good news story. I mean, I think John Blake would say, look, he did pay a cost then. So he's not an exception to the rule that Blake issues. Now, I, to be fair to Blake, I think he's right to say that there is this rule. No one uses the N-word, in a hateful or derogatory way, no white person, and gets away without paying some cost. If they're caught and it's publicized. I think that is true, and I think that's very good. I think that conversation, that was an esteem issue, that was a debate that looked like it might never end, and then it ended. And now white people don't do that. My first prize is really just that the rule is consistent to persons, because given the positive side of it is, I just think that's an axiom of my value system. and non-racialism is an axiom of many people's value systems. So that's something. But it's not just a democratic argument. Also, the sort of more analytic side is if you're coming at it from the other side and you're saying we should have rules that distinguish, that are indexed differently by race, then you're going to keep those esteem teams alive. And the problem about keeping the esteem team alive is you're never going to have an equilibrium of esteem between races. That's the thing that racialists, that's their problem, right? Is they want to say, no, there are these racial esteem teams. And, you know, at the moment, for the last while, the story's been, you got to boost the esteem of blacks. The black esteem team has got to get more esteem and the white esteem team has got to get less esteem. It's not in the nature of the esteem to survive this kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. Even trying to bring down white esteem ends up focusing you on whites in a way that gets you the perverse.
Exactly. It's an attempt. I mean, what was Thomas Sowell's
name for this? The Put me for cosmic in my justice. Place. No, but yeah. Also, he said there was this old line in the South: we need to put blacks in their place. And then he said, you know, not much has changed, excepting for the place. But even if the place that you want to put blackness in is equality, superiority, inferiority, it's all about putting black people in their place. I'm against that. And I'm with Sowell, dude. I'm against that. Don't flippin' put people – there is no racial pigeonhole. Don't flippin' try and make it higher or lower or more triangular or more circular. Just join me. There's one thing that must fall. Let's make that fall. And then all the libraries can – you know, it's like either you keep that idea and you got to lose your fire stations, your libraries, your constitutional democracy, your sense of human decency – or you can keep all of those things and just make that idea of there being a right and wrong place for different races. Make that go away. Okay, so that's that argument. That's, and we've gone on, and I see we're getting to the...
Yeah, we are for time, so I think let's...
My segue is just be careful. We're recording this on Sunday night. By the time you hear it, if you're of the first to hear it, the Russian Duma will have initiated its official conversation on the bill tabled by the Communist Party in the end of January, which I discussed before, the second largest party calling for
the Communist Party to, from beyond the grave, continue to cause problems for the world.
Well, they're the second largest party in Russia, and they're not very communist, but they are very irredentist. They are the party that really wants the Soviet Union's borders to be redrawn as they once were. They tabled a motion for Moscow to recognize Luhansk and Donetsk as independent nations or as part of Russia. If they pass that motion, then it will basically be impossible for Putin not to further invade Ukraine. Ukraine still insists that Russian troops are in the Donbass, but also that they must not invade the Donbass, one of those hilarious paradoxes that only a WASP could ignore. The Washington Post released a survey which found that 8% of Russians think it's a good idea to invade Ukraine, and all of the rest say it's a very, very bad idea. So the notion that Putin wants to invade Ukraine because it would be politically good for him, it would boost his popularity domestically, those people are also treating Russians like they're just not worth listening to, which we at the Institute are very used to because, hey, 80% of South Africans are common sense non-racialists, and everybody finds an easy way to ignore that in London, New York, Washington, Paris, and Berlin. Russians in a similar position here. And Ukrainians, if anything, in a worse position because they're led by sympathizers to neo-Nazis. Their best friend is Joe Biden.
Let's not
that's my summary of the state of play.
But,
watch out for
let's not rehash this because you always do this right at the end. And I want to – no, let's shy away from that. So do you have
facts. I'm just saying some facts. Okay, yes, two good. Hot facts. 8% approval for war, 90% disapproval.
No, you didn't just say facts. You said things. You said things that were facts plus.
No. Facts ultra.
But okay. All right. Do you have any recommendations?
Well, I recommend that you read or listen to the debate in the Russian Duma because it will probably be the determining factor of whether there's a war or not. No.
That's complicating.
You
Move what? Pachimu, davai. We can all, you know, learn a little, live a little. Enjoy yourself a little.
Yeah, I don't know if a parliamentary debate is the best place to start learning another language. But I don't know. I only speak one language, so, you know, maybe I'm wrong.
You go.
So I'd recommend a story on the Middle Eastern English language website, El Monitor. I mean, I've recommended the site before. I've forgotten what the headline was now. I think it was Iran unveils new, or radicals very pleased with new Iranian missile. And basically the story just talks about an editorial in one of the very hardline newspapers in Iran, which is celebrating Iran's new ballistic missile, which has a range of 1,450 kilometers, which basically goes from Iran's western border to Cairo. So, you know, it's definitely all of Israel is in range, and then some. And the name of the missile is the Kebar Shekan, which translates to the Smasher of Kebar, and it's a reference to a historical battle in early Islamic history where a tribe of Jews called, I think, the Kebar was destroyed, or at least forced to submit by an Islamic army. So the editorial goes on to say, quote, the new missile is, quote, capable of dealing maximum blows on the Zionist regime in any potential confrontation. So there's a...
Dude, you know what else is subtle?
Yeah.
Okay, my recommendation, I like that very much. My subtle recommendation, Liz Truss, amongst our colleagues, very popular foreign secretary of the United Kingdom, paid a visit to Moscow over the weekend, where she sported a fur hat to try and look like Margaret Thatcher, which is ridiculous because she's not Margaret Thatcher, firstly, and secondly, it was above freezing.
No one can be Margaret Thatcher. Thatcher is a wonderful.
So that was Liz Truss's first stupid. Her second stupid was that she walked into such a beautiful trap.
The foreign affairs minister said,
you know, why are you complaining about us moving our troops around Rostov and, I don't know, Volgograd?
Verona is the other one.
Yeah. And she said, well, because we don't recognize them as being part of sovereign Russia. And we never will.
Right. And
idiots. Dude, the world is run by idiots. Even the smart people who think those people are the smart people. She's so stupid, she's going to negotiate literally the 100,000 troops that everyone's talking about. Like, these are the two places they're in. She hasn't bothered to figure out the names of those two places. That gives you just a little bit of a flavor of what level of respect. Because it's not actually IQ. She's got a great IQ. She's just too stupid. It's like a military historian talking about the Battle of Normandy and thinking that Normandy's in Spain. It's just sort of disqualifying foolishness, and a nice rhetorical win for the old Ruskies. Not that that's any good because it ups the odds of war, but you should check out, my recommendation is on the Moscow Times. You can check out a series, the piece is called Macron. If you just Google Macron and Putin memes, we'll put the link in the description. You will see the memes that have been made of the meeting between Macron and Putin. They were sitting on opposite ends of a very long white table, and people made some good jokes.
I love some of the very, man.
Just basic about childish.
The way that people set up diplomatic meetings is often so funny, because there's all this like stupid kind of, you know, showy posturing.
It's like
going
you're trying
on.
Yeah, to get it's like maximum very, esteem
but it's very
points.
Lizard-based kind of thing. Yeah, that reminds stupid. Me that of you know, the Byzantine court. Sorry, I don't. You know, we're 15 minutes over time, and I start talking about the Byzantine court. We're not going to finish.
Here we go.
The Byzantine court. One of the ways that they performed diplomacy was very much through a manipulation of the esteem game. Right, the imperial court had this huge array of titles. Just masses of titles. And one of them translated directly to English was something like Super Special Extra Boy. And one of the others, which is also bestowed upon, you know, either a foreign leader who they were trying to woo by giving them basically this title, which also came with a kind of a salary and this prestigious place at the emperor's side, or they'd give it to a local noble to get him on side or whatever. There's another one, which was the Very Super Special Extra Boy. I can't remember the Greek, but when you translate it directly, just say that it doesn't maintain its mystique.
That is, you know, it's such a tragedy about humans that in the end, like, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of people can be sent to their death.
And when,
series of conversations that are framed in,
We laugh at the Byzantine court, but they lasted 1,000 years. It's not like, it's like basically not a modern state around today that's lasted that long. No, can't think of one.
No, what people think is ultimately what matters.
Yeah.
Because you can have the best machine in the world, if you don't turn it on, it's not going to work. You can have the best weather conditions, if you don't plant the seed, you're not going to get a harvest. It really matters what people think. And people turn out, beg your pardon, to all be monkeys. Barely fallen out of the tree. Recently habituated in habit, the old Latin word for wearing clothes, you know, but beneath our clothes, we're still a bunch of flipping monkeys. And so we try and make our clothes sometimes mean more than they possibly can. And our titles and our tables.
That sounds like the ending to a play, like the monologue at the end of a play. But anyway, okay, cool. So thank you very much for listening. If you're still with us, and we hope you enjoyed the show. And we'll see you soon on Two Crickets and a Thorn Tree. Keep the flag of liberty flying.